Hey, greetings, everybody, to another, welcome to another episode of the Book Exchange Podcast, episode 58, coming your way right now, and this episode is called Ghosts, exclamation point, part of our new series, which I sometimes call the exclamation point series, but that's a really lame name, so we got to come up with a better name than that, but we'd like to welcome you into this new episode. It's fun to be here, and before I go any further, I'm going to welcome my co-host. Coming at you from the eastern coast of Maryland, John, are you on and are you ready?
I am on. I am ready. How's everybody doing? And the one thing I'll correct right out of the gate, sort of, is that you said this is a new series, but it's actually not that new because I was, you know, going back through the archives and we've done a couple of these going back as early as episode 24, I think, was our first exclamation pointed episode, which I believe was called Thriller.
Oh, I didn't even know that, and I'd say, you know, we gotta fire that intern.
Sorry, I said it wrong. It's not called Thriller. It's called Thriller. So
yeah, okay. Well, it's new in the sense that we just made it into a series.
Yeah,
even though we've already had a series going. So if we did Thriller, I forgot that completely. I know we did an episode on thrillers, but I didn't know it was exclamation point. And then I know we did Monsters somewhere in the 40s.
That's right.
I think maybe late 30s. And so this would actually be the third one. This one is called Ghosts, and we're looking forward to sharing with you our picks for the selection of ghosts. Now, before I go any further, just like sort of way of setting things up, and then we're going to follow our standard format. But, you know, at least I'll give you the chance to comment on this briefly, at least from where I'm coming, and we've talked about it off camera, so to speak. But where I'm coming from on this topic in this series is it's not necessarily what we're not doing is, you know, these are the best ghost stories that you have to read. We're not doing, here's our comprehensive take on the ghost story genre. I mean, you know, sometimes people talk about the length of our show and we'll get into that in a second here and hint, but, you know, we could have as many hours as we want, and we're not going to cover all the bases, obviously, on the theme of ghosts. In my mind, what we're doing here is, at least when I talk about the books I have come to this episode to discuss, I'm talking about some of my favorites, stories that have to do with ghosts, that have ghosts in them, and they're just like my personal favorites, right? So, like, say, I noticed that, and we'll get into it, but many of my stories that I chose to discuss today are not even sort of like traditional horror stories per se or ghost genre stories. And we'll talk about kind of, you know, because that's a broad term anyway, and like, you know, what constitutes a ghost, etc. It's similar to monsters, right? So from where I'm sitting, I'm talking about some of my favorite stories that have ghosts in them. And, you know, what are the quality of those stories and etc., etc. Are you coming at that from the same angle, John, or do you feel slightly differently? The floor is yours.
I guess I'm doing it a little bit. I'm sharing some of that, but I am also going, I guess I have kind of more of a mixed approach because I am actually going to go a little bit back in time and explore like what are some of the classic or older ghost stories that, you know, are just famous within the genre and make some recommendations there. So I am going to do a little bit of that, sort of looking back at what this genre is about and what are some of the stories that made it famous. But then I'm also going to feature a couple of my favorites, as well as a couple just newer selections that have come out in the last few years that, you know, cover some of this ground just for a sort of variety. So I may be going a little bit broader than you, but having consulted already what our lists are going to be, I think between the two of us, we're going to cover quite a lot. And but you're right. I mean, just like with the other ones we've done, thrillers, monsters, you're never, ever going to cover everything that's out there, not even close. So we're just kind of doing what we always do, which is just highlight, you know, books that have made a mark on us in some way, as well as, you know, stories or novels or whatever that we would highly recommend readers check out if they're not familiar with them.
Yep. Yeah, we're just going to have one of our conversations around the theme. And I think, generally speaking, I think this is true. Like, you usually come with a broader pool of choices than I do. Sometimes I really have long lists that I whittle down, but I think generally speaking, you come with like more, and then you have the your famous categorization where you like put, you know, a bunch in a bucket here and a bunch in a bucket there. So that's pretty consistent with our ways of reading and our kind of our approach to the show in general. And also, like, the first entry I'm going to talk about is kind of a, like, sort of a throwback. I'm going to talk about a couple older stories, but from there, most of mine are fairly contemporary. And, of course, you could talk all day long about ghost stories that are older than 100 years, you know. So, you know, I mean, it's a, you know, it's varied and sundry. It's going to be all over the map as usual. But like John said, having consulted the list that he brought and the list that I brought, we've got another episode with a lot of variety, and there will be many titles that you either didn't hear of or wouldn't have expected to hear of on this episode of the show. So with that, John, I'm going to handle one administrative matter right now, and then we'll do a quick rundown of what we're reading, and then we'll dive into the topic. Do you have anything that you wanted to mention before I do any of those things?
No, I don't. Let's,
okay,
let's,
well,
let's go forward.
All right, I want to revisit briefly the subject of the length of our podcast. So we did receive an email, John, which I didn't even share with you, and there's a reason I didn't. I would say we got a very brief and funny email from somebody who identified themselves as Dumbass Listener, a firm friend of the show that you may be able to guess on your own. I'm not going to give the person's name. But somebody who's very loyally listens to the show and called himself a Dumbass Listener rang in on the subject of the length of our podcast. Now, as a reminder, one of the either the last episode or the episode before, we brought up really quickly the question of, you know, are our podcasts too long? Because we received some feedback about how you really can't make a podcast that's longer than an hour. I don't know what law that is, but because I, you know, I've certainly heard podcasts longer than an hour, but that was the feedback we received. We talked about it briefly one or two episodes ago. And then we put a little call out there, and I think you got some texts from some people you know that are listeners of the show.
Yeah.
And then we received this podcast, I mean this email, which is so short I can just read it. It says, I use the pause button. And then later when I want to continue, I press the play button again. Signed, Dumbass Listener. So thank you, Dumbass Listener, for that, and for affirming what John and I have thought. Now, we're not, you know, we're not cracking on anybody who says our show should be shorter. In fact, I'll just read it. We're generally interested to hear from everybody, and if people think that's the case, so be it. We'd like to know it, and we'd be happy to hear it. But like from where we're sitting, that's kind of our approach, you know. Like if you like the show and you want to listen to it, but you don't have 2 hours to change, you hit pause, you come back to it later. And, you know, I'll just make that joke again that you and I sometimes make, which is that we assure all our listeners that you guys are getting the short, the extra short version of the Book Exchange conversation when it comes to the Lovell Brothers. So first of all, I want to thank Dumbass Listener for ringing in. Also for confirming the way, I think I can speak for John, he and I have kind of always looked at the matter. And I think, like John said last time, I don't think there's any real plan to change the length of the episode. John, did you want to either react to Dumbass Listener or bring up anything that you received in other formats? Here's your chance.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Dumbass Listener, and who I'm sure is not a dumbass. But, you know, we'll a listener is a listener, whether they're a dumbass or Albert Einstein or the Pope or, you know, your buddy Aaron Rodgers, Jude, or whoever, you know, a listener's a listener. Or I should say Mike Tomlin, your favorite coach.
Right.
So, but I appreciate the feedback. And I'll just say this. Like, most of the feedback that we did get on this question was along those lines. Where, you know, individuals saying, we don't really see the length of the show as a problem. You know, you can always, the podcasting apps that are out there allow you to pause and come back and not lose, you know, it's like a bookmark, right? You know, not lose your spot in the book or whatever. And you just pick it up where you left off. So that was, you know, by far and away the feedback we got that, as Jude just said, that kind of gels with how we think about it. So there's really no compelling reason right now for us to change either our format or the length. And I think that's that. You know, if we get a lot of other feedback the other way, we'll certainly acknowledge that. But for now, you know, that should put a bow on this issue.
Yep, I agree. But we want to thank people that have contacted us to let us know their thoughts.
Definitely.
So that takes care of that. John, let's talk about what we're reading right now. I know about one book you've been embroiled in, but can you bring us up to date on what, you know, what your reading has been like recently?
Yeah. And it won't be too long because one of the books I'm reading has become kind of a summer long project for me. And that is the Frederick Douglass biography, which I've talked about on the show a number of times. It's excellent, but just really, really dense. And I've had to sort of break off in order to prepare for episodes that we've recorded. So as a result of that, I'm still working my way through that. And it's okay. It's one of these really long biographies. I feel like I can pick it up at any time and just kind of get, like we were just saying, you know, like you just hit pause and then just pick up with it again. And it's, you know, the story of his life. And it's not his life story, is his life story. So I learn on every page of that book, so I can just pick it up, you know, and just continue learning about the life of Frederick Douglass and everything swirling around him. So that's been great. I'm going to continue to read that book. I will finish it this year, but I've also just kind of gotten over the fact that I'm going to have to break in and read other things, you know, to prepare for shows like the one we're recording right now. So I'm also reading, I'm rereading a book, which I won't even mention the title right now. I'm rereading a book that's going to come up as one of my choices for this topic. So it's going to come up later, but I'm sort of in the middle of that. And I'll get to it when I get to it. So I can easily pass the ball back to you.
All right. Well, I'm in a somewhat similar situation. But I will say this, like, you know, you said, like, we kind of treat the bigger books that we're reading same way, in the same fashion that we were talking about with the podcast, and hit the pause button, come back to it. Although I would say, I think for both of us, again, like our general preferred method is not to do that though. In general, like we usually like, if we take on a big book, because a lot of people just like skip through books habitually, come read 2-3 at a time, and that's their way of reading. Well, I'll speak just for myself, but I don't generally like to do that. Like if I take on a big book, I like to kind of read it through, and then I get to what I want to read next.
Right.
But with this show, sometimes you have to break in, and there are reasons you have to break in, and you do that. So I too have done that recently, although strangely it's not for the purposes of preparing for this show. So I am also reading a very large book, brought up last time. I want to make a couple small corrections. The title of the book is The Dark Descent. It was last episode I said there was no article "The." That was wrong. And I also said, I believe I said the editor's name was William Hartwell. That also was wrong, so I apologize to Mr. Hartwell if he's still out there. It's actually David G. Hartwell was the editor, the guy who brought together this very large horror anthology called The Dark Descent, that I'm currently two-thirds of the way through. It's a 1,000-page book. And last time I couldn't remember the little groupings in the book because it's divided into three sections. I have it here with me now, so I've gotten through two sections that are grouped in interesting categories. First section of stories was called The Color of Evil. The second section of stories was called The Medusa in the Shield. And these were his little groupings of horror categories, which he explains in the introduction to the anthology. And I just started the third one, which has another fantastic title. It's called A Fabulous Formless Darkness, with the last third of the stories in the book. So I'm reading that anthology. It has a lot of great horror stories in it. There's been a couple from Stephen King, a couple from Lovecraft, one from Poe, and like lots of other writers that were more contemporary than the 1980s. So that's really enjoyable. Really like that. And then I broke in, this was totally unplanned. I just came back from vacation, and I have a daughter who is 17 going into her senior year of high school, and she had to read some books over the summer for school. And so she had two of them with her, and she was finishing the one, and it's a short book that I read maybe when I was 15 years old. And I just decided, well, I'm going to celebrate finishing two-thirds of The Dark Descent before I start the final third. Now I'm going to reread this book. It's called Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And I just finished rereading that I thought it would be fun to discuss with my daughter, who can't stand the book and can't stand reading in general, seems like. But she's dutifully reading the books. And I just thought it would be interesting to read a classic book like that that I last read, like, maybe 36 years ago or whatever it was. So I just finished reading that. I won't talk about it, but it was very interesting. I thought it was really good, really enjoyable. She didn't like it.
It was really good and really prescient.
Very prescient, and I literally could remember one detail from that book, which is like embryos and bottles, you know. And we're not going to get into it, but it's just the only detail I could remember. So it was interesting to go back and flesh out the rest of the book. So took a pause. I read Brave New World again, maybe one of the longest breaks I've ever had between reads of a book. And now I'm returning back to The Dark Descent. So that's what I'm reading. And then when we get to the end of the show, John, we'll tease like what's going to be coming up next for us, etc. So I think that does it by way of the first set of preambles here. Are you ready to dive into the world of ghosts?
Yeah, I think I am.
Okay. So, John, I don't really have like some kind of fancy intro to this. I think rather what I will do, we've already kind of even said like kind of what our approach was. I think I'm simply going to pass the ball to you and ask you to hit on your first selection or selections, and then we'll just begin the conversation. If you've got some witty way to introduce us into the spirit world, please do that now.
No, I wish I did, but I don't really. But nonetheless, I think we have tons of material to discuss, so we might as well just dive into the pool. The way I was going to start is, you know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, ghost stories, you know, leading up to this. We've had a few weeks to think about it. Not just picking some of my favorite, either short stories, you know, have ghosts in them or apparitions, or novels from my own shelves, but just thinking about kind of that genre in general. And I sort of realized a number of the stories and tales that popped into my mind in terms of the genre, the ghost story genre, were older ones, at least initially. So I wanted to kind of start off by acknowledging some of the quote unquote classics, or the older, you know, ghost stories that a lot of people will have heard of and that have had a major impact on, you know, sort of the culture over the last like 100 to 200 years. You know, when you think about ghost stories, I mean, you could split hairs and there's a whole bunch of ways that you could talk about what they are and what they aren't and what technically is a ghost story, what isn't, you know. But I don't know about you, but what pops into my mind, the first thing that pops into the mind of majority of people, I think, would be like haunted places, usually like a house that's haunted, an old estate, you know, some kind of building that had previous tenants in it, or some kind of geographical location that has some sort of dark history to it. And, you know, literally ghosts from the past, you know, manifest themselves in these places and they become haunted places, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, most of us probably think of a ghost. When you think ghost story, you think most people, their mind goes to like an old house, an old estate, etc. You know, everybody knows the kind of thing that I'm talking about, and things go bump in the night, or somebody staying there for the weekend, or with a team of researchers or whatever, you know, and weird stuff starts happening, you know, in a sense, like the movie Poltergeist is like that, you know, which is, we're not talking about movies, but that's, anybody who's sort of the generation that we are, you kind of think of stories like that. Am I wrong? Like, you know.
I would say, or maybe like dark places, like a cave or.
Dark places, you know, it could be. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just, you know, dark locales, like that maybe aren't human made, but by and large, yes, like some kind of haunted old thing, place.
Right. Could be a graveyard. It could be an old house. Right. It could be an abandoned building of some kind. Sometimes it's an abandoned, you know, insane asylum. That's the kind of thing that you think about. And I was thinking about that. And the reason most people go there is that there are many, you know, there's a long tradition of sort of like, of these types of stories of like haunted houses or hauntings in various places. And that goes back, you know, kind of, well, you could, depending on who you are, you could trace it back a lot further, but I think that really became popular during like the late Victorian period, you know, we're talking like mid to late 19th century, sort of into the early part of the 20th century. And so there's a number of famous stories from that period that and many of them that I've read, few of them I haven't, and a number of famous authors that are known for this type of story. I think, I don't want to steal your thunder, Jude, but, you know, one of those authors would be Charles Dickens, who actually, he has one very, very famous ghost story, which I think you're going to talk about, but he has another one. I just want to mention this, and I know you're aware of it, and I'm pretty sure you've read it, but I was doing a little research, and like his more frightening ghost story is actually called The Signal Man. You're familiar with that story?
I think so, yes. I think I've read it maybe once.
It has something to do with a guy who's working late at night at a train station, and there's like an apparition that happens in the middle of the night having to do with trains.
Yeah.
But that's just sort of an interesting piece of trivia that he's like, Charles Dickens is best known, his best known ghost story by far, of course, is A Christmas Carol. But he also wrote another famous one called The Signal Man. But Henry James, The Turn of the Screw, that's another very, very famous ghost story. And I want to make sure I brought that one up because it has been adapted many times into films and in various forms. You know, there's an incredible movie called The Innocents from the early 1960s, I believe, black and white film that, you know, was based on the story Turn of the Screw by Henry James. And it basically involves a haunted house. And it's really, I want to recommend that story and that movie because that movie is just an amazing adaptation. I think, yeah. You know, for the time, I think it's from 1961, I want to say. But for the time, you go back and watch it, it's a black and white film, and it's still, I mean, that movie was creepy from the very beginning, before you even see anything. The music is creepy.
Yeah. Yes,
so,
yeah.
And the screenplay was sort of famously written by Truman Capote. So that's an incredible movie, but a later movie called ghost movie called The Others was based on the same story. So you have Henry James, you have Charles Dickens, you have even Oscar Wilde got into the game, and he wrote sort of a parody of ghost stories in this period that was called The Canterville Ghost, which is a fun story. One of the most famous writers that I wanted to bring up in this context, though, and probably you could probably call him the father of the modern ghost story, and that's a guy named M.R. James, who I know we've talked about in the past. I don't know how many of his stories you've read, if any, but he's what really makes him famous is his series of ghost stories that he wrote. Have you ever read any of them?
I've read one story by M.R. James because it was in The Dark Descent in the first two thirds.
Do you remember which one?
No, I can't even remember the name of it. I should have come prepared for that, but I can't remember.
No, that's okay.
But that's a big anthology, man.
Yeah, he's got a lot of them. There are a lot of M.R. James ghost stories, but some of the most famous ones are, there's one called Casting the Runes. And that was also adapted into a really good movie called Night of the Demon. Another one which I want to highlight is called Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, which is a great ghost story. That's been adapted a few times as well, and I've seen at least one version of that movie, and it's really freaky. There's another great one called Lost Hearts, and then he has one that's set in Sweden that has to do with vampires, sort of, and it's called Count Magnus. But M.R. James, I read one volume of his ghost stories, and this was a long time ago. But they're very dark. They're very creepy. And they are usually, you know, they're sort of the classic ghost tale that you might, you know, picture if you think about what's a classic ghost story. The story called Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, involves a guy, like an academic who goes to he goes to this old hotel that's like a seaside hotel in Britain, and he's kind of just convalescing there, and he's walking around one day and he's exploring the grounds, and there's some archaeological digs going on, and I think the professor has like a background in archaeology. Anyway, he's walking around these ruins and he finds a sort of like cleft or sort of like a hole down in the foundation of one of the buildings, and he brings out an ancient bronze whistle. And it has a sort of a Latin inscription on it. And, oh gosh, I can't remember what the inscription said. It doesn't say whistle and I'll come to you, my lad, but it says something like, yeah, I can't remember, but it has this like sort of inscription that he ends up translating. And then, of course, you know, what does he do? He blows the whistle late at night. He's staying at this in this old estate. He's like the only guy staying there. He blows the whistle. And then he starts seeing, as soon as he blows the whistle, it takes course over a couple of days. He starts seeing these sort of like apparitions, these vague apparitions. You know, once he sees like a vague figure and he's looking out the window. Another time he's walking on the beach and he swears there's somebody behind him and he turns around and he sees a gray figure, but then it like disappears. And then it sort of culminates, it's sort of spoiler alert, but it culminates with one very frightening night where he's in the hotel by himself and his door is locked, but he hears there's another bed in the room and he hears like rustling on the bed. And, it, you know, of course he's in the room by himself and he's kind of like, he wakes up and he's trying to figure out what's going on. And then there's this figure that's covered in bed sheets. You know, it's like an ethereal figure, but I guess it takes the bed sheets with him. It just like, you know, rises up in the room and kind of like raises over him. And then like somebody bursts through the door at that moment or whatever. But it's like, it's just like it's like the classic ghost story. And it's really kind of creepy the way it's written. And it's just so much fun. So anybody who would be interested in like, what are like reading quote unquote classic ghost stories, you got to start with M.R. James. And, you know, that volume that I have, it has about 15 of his stories, and they're all memorable. You know, they're all, like, really good. So those are just a few of them that I wanted to mention. The last one I want to mention, there's two more in this sort of category, this sort of brief survey of older stories. One of my favorite writers from that period is Edith Wharton, who's actually an American writer. I don't know how much of Edith Wharton that you've read, Jude, but I think Edith Wharton is a really intelligent and sharp and witty writer, and she often is writing about kind of like upper classes. Like I was thinking, like, why does somebody like Edith Wharton appeal to me but somebody like Jane Austen doesn't? You know, because a lot of times they're writing about the same types of people, but there's like a kind of an edge and a wit to Edith Wharton's work where she's sort of undercutting, you know, what she's writing about. At the same time, it has sort of a satirical edge to it. And sometimes she can just be really blunt and real about what she's writing about and just very frank. There's something about her writing that I really appreciate. But as a young kid, she was, I guess the way she describes it is she's never believed in ghosts, but she's always been scared of ghosts. So her way of working through her sort of fears of ghosts was to write. She wrote a number of ghost stories, and that she didn't believe in the supernatural or ghosts or anything like that, but she wrote a number of famous ghost stories. So there was a volume of ghost stories by her that I read. And they're all really well written. And the thing about her ghost stories is that they all work because of the power of suggestion. Like a lot of times there isn't even like a noticeable apparition, but it's just all about like the atmosphere that she's writing about, or just creepy set of circumstances that kind of give you this vague sort of menacing feel that there's something not quite right about, you know, the places where her characters are. So I really enjoyed, you know, our favorite press, New York Review of Books, put out a volume of her ghost stories. They're really worthwhile. I really enjoyed those. And then the last one I wanted to mention, then I'll turn to you, is there's a much older book. There's a book from 1764 called The Castle of Otranto, which was written by somebody named Horace Walpole. And this is kind of it's generally known as sort of the first quote unquote real Gothic novel. And it literally has to do with like a haunted castle. And there are these people staying in it and they have these, like there's it's very surreal and strange. There's this kind of giant spirit that lives in the castle and it's dressed up as a knight. So at times the characters see these manifestations. Like I remember there's a scene where this woman's looking down the hall and there's this enormous hand, like just a hand with like chainmail on it. And it's like sort of coming down the hall towards her. And at one point there's a character who purportedly is killed by a helmet, like a knight's helmet, but it's like a, really, really large size, and it crushes him. So it's like this really weird sort of surreal, haunted, you know, castle story with this, some really bizarre imagery in it. But that's going back all the way to 1764. And so, you know, that's just to say, and it's a very, it's still kind of a memorable book. It's like, I don't know, it mixes like medieval stuff with like almost like David Lynch. It's like this weird trip when you're reading it. It's very strange and weird. But I kind of really enjoyed reading that because it's so old. But those are just some of the older kind of ghost stories that I think have had an enduring, you know, impact on readers. And I thought would be fun to kind of start off with some of the older classics.
Yeah, and I'm going to continue with that. I have two classics that I want to discuss because my first entry is like a twofer. That's also, it's my way of covering the entire like field of like classic or older ghost stories, you know?
Yeah.
Because I knew that you were going to bring up a handful of other ones. But just question, I know you read, you know, most of the stories or the work of the writers you mentioned, but did you reread The Castle of Otranto?
No, that's just one I had read, you know, in the last maybe 5 years or so.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when you read it the first time, and that one comes up a lot, very influential for some of our favorite storytellers like Guillermo del Toro and others, you know, Stephen King or any of the horror writers of today like that. You see The Castle of Otranto, if I'm saying it right, come up. And I think you bought a used copy. I have one on my shelf that I keep. It's one of those books that I just eye all the time. And it's very short, but I haven't read it yet.
It's really weird.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. But, you know, any book that you see that keeps coming up again and again, it's sort of like that's foundational to a whole subgenre or whatever, you know you're going to have to read at some point.
And I should say that the writer that convinced me to read it was that none other than H.P. Lovecraft. He has this long essay called Supernatural Horror and Literature, I think. That we actually talked about back on episode 40 something, our monsters episode. But
yeah, you brought that up a few times. Yeah.
Yeah. In that long essay, he surveys all these kind of older books that are known for the paranormal and the weird. And he talks a lot about The Castle of Otranto, and that made me read it. But anyway.
Yeah. And Edith Wharton, I've actually never read any of her ghost stories, but I've read a couple of her novels. She's one of those writers I can never remember which title I've read, you know, The House of Mirth or The Custom of the Country. I don't even know if those are all her books. I know I've read, what's the famous one in New York? You know, well, there's a few in New York, but
The Age of Innocence.
The Age of Innocence, thank you. And I've read one or two others. And Ethan Frome. I like her a lot. Yeah, Ethan Frome. I'm not even sure if I've read Ethan Frome. That's her famous novella. But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned, I was thinking the same thing, like, why is John like Edith Wharton and not, you know, other books of, like, quote-unquote books of manners or something? But then, you know, if you think about it, though, there's, like, I believe Edith Wharton was the early in the 20th century, and Jane Austen wasn't a contemporary with Napoleon. So we're talking about at least 100 years.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good point.
That may explain some of the reason why there's a bit more of an edge to Edith Wharton than there might be to Jane Austen. But anyway, for me, John, when you know, I was like, I can't bring up, you know, I don't, you know, there's no way I can cover the whole sub-genre of, like, old ghost stories. So I just thought of two that, to me, were, like, you know, kind of the quintessential, you know. And quintessential not only for the sub-genre, if you will, but also for me. Like, I think even more so, you brought up one of them already, but even more so to me, if you were, I think, it's pretty close, but if you ask me for, like, the quintessential literary ghost, I might have to say Hamlet's father in the play Hamlet, you know. Mm-hmm. So that goes back to, I looked this up, kind of right around the turn of the 17th century, so, like, 1599 through 1601. That's when people speculate that Hamlet was written by Shakespeare. And I don't have to get all into it, but, like, you know, that's the, you know, obviously in the play Hamlet, you know, Hamlet is the Prince of Denmark, and his father is murdered, And early in the play, he gets this visit from the ghost of his father, who lets him know what happened to him and asks him basically to avenge his death, you know? And that scene that's in, like, the first or second act of Hamlet, you know, you got the two guys up on the rampart that watching, you know, for invaders from the east or whatever out there in the castle in Denmark, and they see an apparition coming toward the wall and one night, and then they kind of cower and live through it, and then they go and they recognize that it's the former king, and so they don't know what to do, so they go tell Hamlet, you know, we saw your dad last night in the woods, and he's like, you know, my dad's dead, so that's not true, and they're like, well, you know, why don't you come up on the wall with us tomorrow night? So he goes up there, and then the ghost appears to Hamlet, and they have this whole dialogue, famous dialogue. That to me is like, you know, I don't, you wouldn't call Hamlet, well, I don't know, because like, part of the debate is kind of what's a ghost story and what isn't. But that's probably the most famous literary ghost in my mind, you know, would be that. And I don't even remember his name now. It's not Claudius. You remember the king's name, that Hamlet's father's name?
I thought it was Claudius.
Maybe it is Claudius. trying to think of...
Yeah.
Anyway, his father murdered by his brother, who then marries his wife, which sets up all the events in the play Hamlet. So,
right.
But that dialogue that they have where the Hamlet, you know, sees the ghost, I think he says, like, speak or something like that, and the ghost, like, talks to him, you know, and he's, like, afraid, but also just, like, kind of totally gobsmacked and enthralled by seeing his father. It's like, why is his father here? And I think Hamlet kind of suspected that something was up already, but when his father confirms it, Hamlet has his sort of fatal purpose for the rest of his life, and it just drives the action of the entire famous story there in Hamlet. And then for me, you know, the classic ghost story, you know, of all time for me is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. You know, listeners of this show know that I'm a huge fan of Charles Dickens, you know, and that I read a book of his every year. I've read The Christmas Carol, I think twice, maybe three times. I haven't always included it in, like, annual readings and stuff. Although I know of, I've heard of a lot of writers who read it annually, like around the holidays. It's just, everybody knows the story of A Christmas Carol, but it's just such, you know, enduring work that centers around spirits or ghosts from kind of the other side, which are famously four of them. You know, the three ghosts of Christmas, past, present, and future, and then the problem, you know, another of the most famous ghosts in literature from the very first sentence of the book, Marley was dead, is the ghost of Jacob Marley, who, very similar to, in a way, to Hamlet's father, visits Ebenezer Scrooge at the beginning of the story, and what he has to tell him kind of drives the whole rest of the plot, you know. So the ghost of his former business partner shows up in the middle of the night in this dark house that Scrooge lives in and kind of drives the rest of it. Classic work with ghostly figures in them. It's interesting to me how different the ghosts are one from another. And it's all, you know, most people always find, you know, the ghost of future, Christmas future, to be the most enthralling and definitely the creepiest because he's the most death-like figure, you know, mm-hmm. perhaps signifying, you know, the unknown quality of the future or the, you know, Dickens's sort of dim vision of what the future held, etc. But there's so much to unpack in that great moral fable, but those are probably the most memorable ghosts in all literature to me, are the ones in A Christmas Carol. So I'll just leave it there. Do you have anything that you want to say about those entries to the old ghost?
Yeah, I think those are amazing choices. I mean, those are definitely some of the most famous ghosts in all of literature, so it's appropriate to bring them up. Even though, I mean, A Christmas Carol, it's called A Christmas Carol, right?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm blanking. I was about to say A Christmas Story, but Christmas Carol is you know, one that most people, at least in the Western world, know, and is most certainly a ghost story, as you just described. You know, it's like all the action is driven by one ghost or another. Hamlet, not necessarily known as a ghost story, but obviously there's a prominent ghost in it. And not the only prominent ghost in famous Shakespeare plays, by the way, because when you mentioned that you were going to talk about it, I kind of immediately thought of Macbeth, you know, which is a play that I've seen performed, you know, and on stage in New York City, and it's always interesting to see, but how they're going to, you know, stage the ghost scene. But there's a very, very famous scene where, you know, Macbeth has murdered one of his rivals and friends, and the friend shows up in the middle of a banquet and kind of disrupts the banquet, but is only seen by Macbeth and nobody else. But there's been all kinds of, like, incredible portrayals of that ghost, and it's always a very dramatic moment. I think it ends the first act of the play. But anyway, you know, so that was another one I thought of, and it's interesting. I'm sure there are other examples in Shakespeare even. So it makes me, I wasn't planning on doing this, Jude, but it makes me want to take just a slight diversion that maybe we should have done in the beginning. And I'm going to, this is one of these famous moments that we do to each other sometimes where we totally put each other on the spot. All right. So get ready. I'm going to put you utterly on the spot and just say, ask you a question point blank. You know, we should maybe have, if we had this idea, we should have started this way. We don't have to get into a long philosophical discussion, but do you even believe in ghosts?
Do I believe in ghosts?
And there's a reason I'm asking the question that is related to the topic. But, you know, kind of briefly, would you say that you're, you know, most people are either, it's like you're a believer or you're not a believer. So where do you stand?
Well, it's a hard question to answer.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think, you know, I hope I'm not wrong. And you have, like, a different answer. The answer for me is, I think no. You know, yeah. I don't believe in ghosts, at least in the sense of human loved ones can revisit us, and I won't go on a length, but in some, like, partially corporeal way or vaguely corporeal way after they have died, or, you know, whether we knew them or not, I don't believe in that physical manifestation or semi-physical manifestation of a ghost. I won't go on about this. I do believe that you can be, quote, visited in some way by people that have gone before you or that have died, particularly loved ones. And, you know, to explain why I believe that would probably be for another show.
Right, so, right. And I think,
you know, that's my answer.
Well, and here's why I understand the distinction that you just made. I think that is different. You know, that's not technically what we're talking about, but I think, you know, that's, what you're talking about is, you know, can a former loved one or someone in your life, you know, still inhabit your psyche in some way? And I think the answer to that is definitely yes, you know. And we've both had personal experiences with that. But the reason I put you on the spot and ask you that is that it's connected to, like, why have these stories endured and why are they so popular? I was thinking about this a little bit. And I know there are plenty of people who actually do believe that they've seen ghosts or they've experienced some kind of ghostly phenomenon, and that's fine. I personally am with you. I just think my general worldview and the way I see the world and answer the big questions of life doesn't really allow for, I don't think it's possible, you know, for somebody who has died to revisit this world in some kind of phantom form, you know. But yeah. So... Yeah. But then why are ghost stories interesting to me? And I just think really briefly, I think the reason they're always so fascinating and they've continued their hold on us, you know, as a species is just it taps into this very, very strong desire. Well, first of all, it taps into experiences that are common to all of us, which is the loss of somebody and grieving and, you know, being separated from someone, you know, in the way that death does, you know, like it's a permanent separation. And how can you get that person back? Is there a way for that person to come back? That's just a natural kind of question and feeling that we all have. But I think what ghost stories do particularly well is they just allow us to explore, you know, these emotions of grief or loss or mourning and kind of just imaginatively explore, you know, what would it be like if we could somehow get back in touch with somebody who has left us, you know, and that experience is common to everybody. We've all lost somebody important to us in one way or another. So it would make sense that through stories, we as a species, you know, might imagine, well, what if somebody could come back? And that's just a manifestation of our desire to not be separated permanently from those we love. Is kind of a short way to say it. So I think that, I think the popularity of these stories, you know, connects to that sort of universal experience that we all have of wishing there's some way we could, either wishing there's some way we could get back in touch with somebody who has left us, or being afraid that somehow somebody could, you know, break the bonds of death and re-enter our world because of whatever circumstances, you know. So these are sort of universal emotions that I think these stories tap into particularly well. And we're going to see in some of my, some of our other picks, you know, how this device is sort of is used, you know, to explore things like grief or trauma or whatever. I think it's safe to say that a lot of our picks kind of delve into that.
Yeah, and I would just add in one sentence, I agree with all that you just said, and I think it was said pretty well. I think another part of it, which is not exactly the same, is also just the human inability to apprehend what death means or is also feeds into it. Like, it's not just, you know, kind of wishing that people were still there, that we're not there, but it's just even trying to get our head around the idea of death at all probably, right, also contributes to the appeal of these stories in some way. Or at least, you know, I look at things from the point of view of a writer, and it definitely would appeal to me if I was trying to write one. That would be one of the reasons, you know, would be to try to just grasp the finality or the mystery of what death is. But anyway, go on.
Well, and if you were finished talking about your two classic ghost stories, this kind of segues me into another book that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Go on.
And an example of what we're talking about here, and I think a really poignant and really well-written example, is actually a recent book that has a lot to do with ghosts, or ghosts feature prominently in it. And it's written by the writer George Saunders, this is actually his only novel. He's, like, very famous for his short stories and some nonfiction essays and whatnot, but he's made a name for himself through the short story form. But he did, it was a big deal back in 2017 when he came out with his first novel. And his first novel was a ghost story in many ways. And it was called Lincoln and the Bardo. And it was a, I think it won the Man Booker Prize, which comes out of England, which is a major literary award. But it was kind of a big publishing event when it came out. Not just...
Well, not to interrupt you, John, but also it was the first book that, The Booker Prize was controversially open to writers from America, and it was he was the first writer to win it. But anyway,
okay, yeah, I forgot about that, but that's interesting. And the reason I wanted to bring, I read this book, and that's the book, by the way, I mentioned when you said, "What are you reading?" I said, "Well, we're going to get, there's one book besides the Frederick Douglass biography that we're going to get to a little bit later, and it's this one. I've been rereading Lincoln and the Bardo." Because I remember when I first read it, it had a pretty big effect on me. I remember it being a very unique and interesting story. And it's also just, it's kind of remarkable because it's his first novel, but it's a powerful novel. But I wanted to go back and, you know, A, because I knew it featured ghosts, and B, you know, just kind of remember why it was so impactful. And, you know, the reason this book succeeds as well as it does, and it's as powerful as it is because it's really just a book about grief and about loss. And again, I think that's something that, especially in this case, it has to do with a parent. You know, the book, just briefly, is about the loss of the son of Abraham Lincoln while he was in the White House. He's sort of newly in the White House. It's, I think, 1 year into his presidency. You know, the Civil War is raging, and in the midst of everything going on politically, he loses his young son, who's about 9 or 10 years old, who has like a bad fever, and he ends up dying. And the son is buried in a cemetery in Washington, D.C., and the whole novel takes place within that cemetery. But what's so interesting about it is the novel consists of the voices of all the people who are buried in the cemetery. And they are kind of narrating, and they watch as the young Willie Lincoln is buried in the cemetery, and then late at night, and apparently this historically was true, Abraham Lincoln would steal out of the White House on a horse, and he would ride over to the cemetery in the middle of the night and visit his son's mausoleum in the cemetery because he was so broken up about his death. So George Saunders kind of took that story from history, and he created this whole fascinating kind of Greek chorus of voices from that cemetery. And the entire novel, it's a very unusual structure. It's narrated by a whole host of voices of different people who are residents of the graveyard, and are kind of, they're sort of in this like, I don't want to call it a waiting room, but they're kind of in this waiting period between this life and the next life. And that's where the allusion to the bardo comes in. The bardo is, I believe it's from Buddhist, I don't want to say theology, but it's a Buddhist concept of sort of an in-between state between, you know, our lives here and what's next. Kind of like, a little bit like purgatory. Even though Buddhism and Christianity don't have a whole lot in common. But it's this kind of way station between this life and the next life. And that's what this cemetery ends up being. And you have this very haunting, kind of unusual novel of just that. It's really a portrait of one of a man's grief over losing his son. But with this technique of bringing in all these other voices, it allows Saunders to explore all kinds of other losses and tragic deaths. And so the whole book is kind of like becomes this kind of long meditation on separation between, you know, of people from their loved ones, and kind of, and it's just very powerfully rendered. And so it's a very unusual take on the ghost story, but it's very moving. And, you know, just, and I'm definitely not going to get into this a lot, but just from a personal standpoint, I have a friend who had recently lost a son of his, who was a teenage son. That's all I'm going to say. But that was it was just a couple months ago. It really impacted our whole community. And now going back and reading this book, which is very much about a father's grief over losing a son, it is like twice as powerful to read this book. It's very, very, it's a very moving book, but it also, you know, there's a lot of ghostly apparitions in it, which, and it allows Saunders, who has a very vivid imagination, and he imagines these different manifestations of different ghosts, and some of them are really wild, and, you know, so it kind of, he lets his imagination run wild, but he keeps it very much grounded in, you know, heartbreak and tragedy and grief. And so it's a very sort of a melancholy book, but it's kind of, the imagination's really wild, and it's also very, you know, I find it to be very moving in parts too, in the way that only an accomplished writer can do. So that's a kind of a high recommendation from me, even though it's a very sad book, but and not your typical ghost story like I was describing before, you know, with haunted castles and, you know, bumps in the night and whatnot, but certainly a very powerful one. So that was one I definitely want to work into the show, Lincoln and the Bardo.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. It sounds like a very powerful book and a really good example of a ghost, kind of a, perhaps not the first ghost story that comes to mind when you think about this type of book, you know. And some of the other ones we talk about, it's like a lot of variety and not like between our two lists. But that, I've never read that. I've read George Saunders before, as you know. Like, I've read two or three of his books. I think you've read perhaps a little more than me. I admire him greatly. I admire his talent greatly. I don't always connect well with his stories, but he's sort of universally, you know, renowned as a short fiction writer. So it was a big deal when he came out with the novel. You know, as it is when somebody is famous for stories finally, you know, caves to pressure, writes a novel. And then what he chose to write about is a very fascinating subject. And I certainly would read it. It wasn't, you know, necessarily on the top of my list. But I don't even know why, but I didn't connect the fact because I was, you know, being your twin brother, I knew about your friend with the loss. You know, I knew about the impact that had on you, your family, and your community. Didn't think about that when I saw you had Lincoln and the Bardo on your list. I can imagine why that would make this sort of reread of the book a different experience.
I actually didn't think about it either at all until I started reading it. And then there are, there are a number of very moving passages of Lincoln sitting with his, you know, dead son, or, you know, the parent Lincoln and Abraham and Mary Lincoln kind of mourning their son. And just like, it was almost too hard to read in passages because it was just so too close to home, given what had happened to somebody who's a really good friend of mine. And, you know, it just shows it's a very powerful book, but I think you would appreciate it because it has such an unusual. The other thing I didn't say, it has this very unusual structure. So it's like this, it's just all told. The whole book is told by a chorus of different voices who keep bringing in. And you're kind of piecing together who those people are just through what they say and what they describe. But then it's also, it has these alternate chapters that are just fragments from other writings that are, were contemporary to Lincoln in these events. So there was a memoir by someone who was a maid in the White House. You know, there's a, an account, there are several accounts of the Lincoln White House written by people who were close to it. You know, some of them are letters between Abraham Lincoln and somebody. You know, there's a memoir from his Secretary of State talking about these events. So it's just like this kind of mosaic of all these either imagined or historical sources that are brought together in this very unusual way, but just really just highly imaginative.
Well, when you were talking about it, it reminds me, I want to throw this out there, even though I haven't read this book, but just to maybe whet the interest of some of our listeners, there is a famous book written in the Irish language, a Gaelic language, that has a number of different translations. I think it might be from the last century. I'm not sure. But it, one of the translations, it's called The Dirty Dust. I think that, you ever heard about that book? I think that translates,
I don't know,
a few different ways. It's written by somebody with a Gaelic name. I'm looking at it. I can't read it, but, you know, Martin O'Cadhain or something, you know, it's a Gaelic language name that I'm mangling. But the reason why I bring it up is because it is available in an English translation, and it's famous because it is the story of an Irish community that's narrated by all the people in it lying underground in a graveyard. So the whole book is told in dialogue, and it's just this raucous dialogue between these dead Irish people, you know, going back and forth from grave to grave. So, like, that's a, you know, kind of an obscure but sort of famous book called The Dirty Dust. It reminded me of that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the whole discussion, and I'm going to segue into my next one, if that's okay.
Well, why don't we, let's take a fast break really quick, and then we'll pick that up.
Well, yeah, I will. I'm going to make one more point, and then we'll take a quick break.
Okay.
Without getting into the next book, though, but just to, like, that, what you were talking about there when you're talking about Lincoln and the Bardo, you know, and how, you know, the experience of reading the book now. I mean, that's like, it's a self-evident point, but that's like, this is part of the whole bag with why we read literature in the first place, you know. Like, it's just this way to, you know, you're talking about what your friend went through and how, you know, and this particular genre and all these things, like, you know, there are qualities of this discussion of stories of this nature that are things that are impossible for us to grasp, or an impossible experience for us to grasp that somebody else went through, you know. And that's why you go to literature in the first place, right? Because, like, novelists and story writers, fiction writers help us to understand things that we couldn't possibly grasp based on our own experience, you know?
Right.
And that's why you read a book like, in a way, like Lincoln and the Bardo, or books about, you know, spirits or ghosts, instead of, because you're trying to, you know, get your mind around something that is just sort of unreachable either to you based on your own experience or to you just based on your humanity, you know? So that's like kind of why we go to some of these stories and why a story like Lincoln and the Bardo would be a useful experience or like a moving experience for you, because it helps you get something of your brain around this unexplainable and impossible experience for you to share with another human being who's gone through it. That makes any sense.
Exactly. Yeah, it does. It does. Because it's just beyond, just in the way that ghosts are sort of beyond us. We don't fully understand what's going on. These emotions and some of these losses, it's just beyond us to try to explain. So.
That's right. All right. So let's take a quick break, and then we will be back to continue with our lists.
Okay, good.
Okay, we're back, folks, and I think we were about to segue into another selection here from my co-host here, Mr. Jude Lowell. Jude, go ahead.
Thank you very much for that, by the way. All right. So the next book I want to bring up is called Beloved. It's written by Toni Morrison. I am not an expert on Toni Morrison.
You're bringing out the heavy. Sorry. I'm just trying to make a little comment. I wish it was easier to do that, but you're bringing out the heavy hitters now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, she is a heavy hitter. Yeah. Kind of, I think she earned that, right? You know, she's no longer with us. American Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison, and probably her most favorite book, famous book called Beloved, which won, I think, several big prizes, you know. But anyway, I was starting to say, I'm not an expert on Toni Morrison. I can't speak with real authority on her work, you know. But I was thinking about all the books that, you know, we could mention related to this theme of ghosts. And, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, this will give me the chance to kind of, again, champion Toni Morrison in general. And it's also the only book on my list that's written by a woman. Happens to be an African-American woman. And it's also just a really, really important and powerful novel that happens to have a ghost in it. It's like a major figure. So for all those reasons, I wanted to bring it up. I will not do a good job of summarizing it. And I also have read it only once, and it was a number of years ago. But the ghost part of it, I sort of remember. And I have a lot of thoughts about Toni Morrison in general, but the best way to hear some of those is to go all the way back to episode 5, I think it is. I think it's episode 5 in the history of this show where we took part 1, you know, someday we'll do another one for sure, if not more, but where we talked about some of our favorite female writers. And I talked for a while about Toni Morrison and her work, but mm-hmm. this is like three years ago. So if anybody wants to check that out, you can hear more of my thoughts on Toni Morrison. But Beloved is this novel, for those who haven't read it, that's set around the time, or I think a little bit after the time of the Civil War, if I'm not mistaken. And it's about the central figure of a woman, a mother, with the name of, I never know how to say it. I don't know if it's Seth or Sethe. S-E-T-H-E. Do you know how to pronounce that, John?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't either. But anyway, she's the central figure. She's based on a real-life figure. So Toni Morrison, who worked for years in publishing, had already established herself as a novelist. And this book came out in the mid-80s, I believe, 1987. She came across somehow in her work or in her research as a writer this anecdote about a woman who was a slave, a black woman who was a slave in the South, who killed her children rather than as a means of preventing them from becoming slaves themselves. And that is the sort of the central concept that also takes place, not to be too much of a spoiler, but that's like the big, you know, the big catalyst or big sort of idea or metaphor, or I don't know what the right, it's not a metaphor, but I don't know what the right term is, behind her fictional treatment of that story, which is the novel Beloved. And that by itself is such an incredibly powerful, obviously, you know, thing to have in a novel. And it's so emblematic of the type of thing that Toni Morrison would put in her fiction. She's a woman who wrote with great authority and power about her characters and what they were going through, suffering, racial injustice, you know, indignity, etc. I can't think of any writer really that I've ever read who does a better job of kind of conveying what those experiences are like as powerfully as Toni Morrison does. And the whole notion of killing one of your children because you're trying to put them in a safer place than what they would experience if they were allowed to live speaks volumes, obviously. But to bring it back to the ghost. It sure does. But to bring it back to the ghost theme, you know, it's this sprawling novel in which this woman at some point during the story, because a lot of Morrison stories jump around a lot through time, but she has these young children, and she attempts to kill all of them to save them from becoming slaves. She only succeeds in killing her oldest child. And when her child was buried, she had almost no money, and the only thing that she could afford to put on the tombstone was the word beloved. So, and then as this story unfolds, Seth has moved on in time. She has another daughter whose name is Denver. And one of the most interesting things about Morrison's novels is the name she gives her characters, both male and female. So you always remember the name Denver as Seth's daughter. But anyway, she's raising this other daughter, a headstrong daughter named Denver. And they're going through their lives in the South, kind of a post-Reconstruction. And this woman, this strange, mysterious woman, shows up out of nowhere one day who calls herself Beloved. And the rest of the story unfolds with this strange character who often behaves strangely, ingratiating herself into the lives of Seth and her daughter and the men that are around, and has a lot of strange behaviors and strange qualities. And the question kind of continues throughout the rest of the story as to whether or not this is either the spirit of her daughter Beloved, or is it a totally different person, or is it a ghost? Is it a human? Is it like some kind of reincarnation? And there's that whole mysterious element is tied up into this dramatic story. And as the story goes on, Seth becomes more and more convinced that Beloved is her daughter, you know, and events take many dramatic turns, you know, and tragic turns, but that's the essence of the story. But the sort of the specter of this killed first daughter hangs over not only the whole story that you experience as the reader, but it also hangs over the whole relationship between the mother and the living daughter, Denver, and causes a lot of complications there. And it's an incredibly powerful story, and it's very heartbreaking. It's very hard to read, but it's once you read it, you never forget it. But this whole idea of the ghost of her daughter that she dispensed with in order to try to save her sort of, I hate to say this, but haunts the whole book and really makes it a powerful and moving story. If you haven't read it, you should read it. I think it's a very important American novel, and you're certainly never going to forget it. Is there anything you want to say about Beloved, John?
I could add a couple comments. I'm hearing an echo again, so hopefully that won't last too long. It certainly belongs in this discussion, and it's like you were just saying, if you haven't read it yet, you should read it. I mean, it's one of these books that, this is a cliche, but if you're putting together a list of like required reading for American citizens, it'd be hard to keep this one off, you know, given the experience of, obviously African Americans in this country, particularly the women and the children. And I think I remember the book has some kind of dedication. It's like to the 66 million or something. And that refers to all the people who have been brought over as slaves, you know, to the United States from African countries or other countries. You know, it's like that right there. I mean, she knew what she was dealing with, that she knew the power of the material and what she was, you know, grappling with here. Obviously it's a lot more than just a ghost story. Let's put it that way, you know? Yes. And then, the other thing is I know I'm pretty sure that this is the case. And I think we may have talked about it before, but I don't remember. I don't think you mentioned it, but this whole book is based on a real incident, right? On like a historical person that,
I did say that. I think she came across it in research or something, but yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry if I missed that little, but you know, the fact that it's based on an actual case of a woman who, you know, escaped, I think from the South into like Ohio, which was a free state, and who had killed at least one of her children for that exact reason, you know, it's just, you know, she's not, it would be powerful enough if she was imagining this story as a story of, you know, indicative of the traumas of African, you know, American women in this country and slavery, but it's not that. It's like basically it's a novelization of something that happened, you know, for real, and maybe I'm sure more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's just, I mean, it's not only is it one of the most powerful ghost stories you'll ever read, but it's just one of the most powerful American novels, period. You know, and I read it a long time. I don't remember a lot about it, but I do remember, you know, the power of it. And it's just not an easy read either, just in terms of her writing, but more in terms of like the emotions of it. It's just really dark and really difficult stuff to confront. But, and that's the word I would use, because that's the, you know, that's what she wants you to do with this novel, is confront the truth of what so many, you know, African-American women went through, and African-Americans in general, but the women in particular who were trying to raise children under these, you know, unthinkable circumstances. So,
yeah, and Toni Morrison really was a genius. And just by way of conclusion, just to, you know, because I've already been pretty clear that I think people should read this book and should read her, but she had a way of writing, and I'm talking not about, has nothing to do with her gender or her race. She had this way of writing with tremendous authority that transcends most writers of any stripe that I know of. There was a way, not only was she confronting these horrible realities that happened in the history of this country, but she had just this way of doing it beyond her own identity that really made it real and really impact. So she, you know, essential reading, in my opinion. But anyway, over to you. Like, where do you go from there?
Well, I think what we have to do from there is to bring up one that's more fun, you know, because that's like, I mean, I think Beloved is everything you said and more. It's essential reading, but it's very, very, very heavy. And so was Lincoln in the Bardo in some ways. So we need to lighten things up a little bit. And I'm gonna right go on. Back. And we're going to talk, I'm certainly going to talk about a few more contemporary novels here in a little bit that I wanted to bring up. But I'm going to harken back to the first part of my comments, which is like, you know, the quote unquote classic ghost stories, which involve hauntings and, you know, creepy locales and stuff. And the other famous book that it's kind of one of the quintessential books in this genre that it'd be impossible to have this discussion and not at least bring up in passing. It's called The Haunting of Hill House. It's by Shirley Jackson. It was written in 1959.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic, haunted house stories that are out there, certainly in America. It's one of the reasons it's endured in popular culture because it's been adapted so many times. It was adapted again recently on Netflix. They did a whole series, Haunting of Hill House, that was sort of loosely based on the novel. You know, there's been at least two movie adaptations of this book. And the original one is the best one, in my opinion, from 1963, directed by Robert Wise. It's still, again, black and white ghost movie, but it's still pretty, you know, for the time, didn't have a lot of technology going into the special effects and stuff, but just the stuff they do with the camera and some of the techniques they use, it's still pretty effective. But this is just a fun book because it's become a cliche now, but at the time it was, you know, it's 1959, novel written by a woman. She had read, I think in California, she'd read an article about, you know, people who were investigating a house that was purportedly haunted. She wanted to try her hand at a ghost story. She wrote this novel called The Haunting of Hill House. And it's just, it's literally, I was starting to say before, it's like it's become a cliche sort of plot now where you have a group of people who decide to like move into a supposedly haunted house for a weekend or for a period of time to investigate, you know, some of the rumored happenings that have been going on there. And that's basically what happens here. You have an older man who's sort of like a professor, and he comes in with his wife, and he's joined by a younger lady with her, another person who's helping them to do research. So you have kind of an older couple, and then you have a younger woman and a man, and then there's a caretaker couple that lives in the house. in Hill House, and they just spend like a weekend there, and the whole novel is just kind of like it just kind of details all the sort of creepy happenings that happen there, and none of it is, it's not like really sensational, it's not like a violent book, but they're just like weird, it's just sort of the quintessential classic story where weird things start to happen. They start to hear noises in different parts of the house. It's all kind of just done through the power of suggestion. At one point, the young woman is sleeping in her room, and there's like, she can hear someone trying to get in the door, and there's this loud like banging and rattling on the door, but nobody was there, you know. And then at another point in the night, she says to one of the other people, "Thanks for coming into my room and holding my hand." And the person says, "Well, I was never in your room, so somebody was holding her hand." You know, just kind of. Again, these things seem sort of cliche now, but in this book, they weren't. You know, it's just like this book was really effective for its time, and it's still effective when you read it today because it's a well-written book. And, you know, there's other things like strange writing appears on the wall, nobody knows why. You know, there's all kinds of things happening in this house to the point where it basically drives the people in the house mad. And then I don't mean to spoil it, but it's an old book and an old movie. But at some point, you know, the young woman is like, "I can't take it here anymore," because the house is essentially cursed. And she's like, "I can't take it here anymore. I got to get out of this place." And she escapes and gets into a car, drives down the road, and she immediately like plows into a tree and is killed in the car accident. You know, and that's sort of the end of the book. It's like, you can't escape Hill House, you know, and it's just. It's become kind of like the elements of this book have become so familiar to us now that it's hard to really, you know, gauge the impact of it when the book came out. But there's a reason that this book has endured. It's just one of the most classic and famous haunted house stories that you'll find. And it's still, I mean, the way it's written, it's very well written, has a famous, you know, opening paragraph. And it kind of just gets its hooks into you early, and it's just one of these fast reads. So it's another one of these famous ghost stories that if you're at all interested in this genre, like, you just have to put it on your list. So I had to mention it. So I can't remember, have you read this book, or have you read Shirley Jackson before? You probably read The Lottery, her famous short story.
Oh, look at the time, John. We better move on. I'll turn to my next. I'm ashamed. I've never read. No, I have read Shirley Jackson. In fact, you gave me a couple years ago as part of The Exchange with an X, a collection of her like creepy stories.
Yeah.
I forget exactly what the collection was called, but I certainly read and I certainly liked them. I remember a couple of those stories well. And I've read The Lottery, which was not in that collection. Her famous short story, The Lottery. But I've never read The Haunting of Hill House. I've just come up again and again, and I've never seen any of the adaptations either. So that's a gap for me. That's one I got to read.
If you watch any of the adaptations, you got to go to the first one, which is the 1963 black and white version. There was a terrible remake made in 1999. That's literally the last thing we'll have to say about that. And then, you know, the Netflix show, we've talked off air, Mike Flanagan, you know, he's kind of done a lot of sort of creepy, stories and movies for Netflix. You know, you kind of know what you're getting there, but it's only very loosely based on the original material. But the original stuff it's just classic. I hate to use that, you know, word, that sort of empty of meaning now, but it's, you know, you kind of recognize the type of story that it is right away, but it still kind of drags you along with it. And there's enough of a mystery to it that you don't know where it's going. And plus, Shirley Jackson is a very good writer, a capable writer, and so you're in good hands. Someday you'll read it and you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, there's no doubt that I'll read it someday, and I was very impressed by her just from the writing perspective and reading the stories that I have read, you know. So, yeah, I'll definitely get to that one. Well, I'm going to stick with kind of fun for 300, Alex. You know,
nice.
We hit so many. Although, you know, you could argue that this one isn't that fun. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it. We always say that. But for two reasons.
Yeah.
One is, everybody knows it. already. And number two, I've talked about it before, but you know, I mean, we can't be on this topic without going to Uncle Stevie, you know, for sure. So one of my favorite writers in general, full stop, is Stephen King. Anybody listening to the show know that. And I was thinking about a lot of his stories. Stephen King's done it all in the horror genre. So, you know, if you want a story about zombies, he's written it. You want a story about killer cell phones, he's written it. If you want a story about werewolves, he's written it. And he's definitely written ghost stories before, although it's like not the most prominent theme in his work. And if you start really looking through his work, you know, there aren't a lot of really traditional ghost tales. There is a famous ghost story he wrote called Sometimes They Come Back, made into a horrible TV movie. But it's one of his classic stories. It's from my favorite Stephen King collection, which is called Night Shift, from early in his career. And that's a story about these teenage hoodlums who get killed and, you know, come back, you know. But, and then I really thought hard about talking about the book It, because most people don't see that as a ghost story. But you and I were talking about it off camera. But it kind of is. It's just, instead of a haunted house, Stephen King had this great idea to have an entire town that was haunted by a malevolent spirit. This, in this case, in It, it's Derry, Maine. But it's hard to kind of call that. I mean, you can't call it a ghost story. But then I kept coming back to the one novel I want to bring up, which is The Shining, which everybody knows The Shining. But that's just a Stephen King novel that is, you know, set in this big hotel that the guy, like, you know, the main character of the book, Jack Torrance, becomes a caretaker of over the winter. And that is just, you talk about a haunted house tale. That is a big, big, big old house that is jammed to the rafters with ghosts. You know, and to me, that's kind of, I almost would have to call that kind of the quintessential Stephen King ghost story. You know, it's got a lot of horror elements in it, but it's filled with the spirits of dead people, you know, kind of from floor to rafter. And everybody knows from the famous novel and from the famous movie, you know, like there are full sequences in that book where there's like an entire ballroom filled with, you know, spirits of dead people. There's like, you know, the bartender, there's like the, you know, like, the, you know, the dead woman in room 237 and like all this kind of stuff. It's just a huge classic Stephen King novel that in which there are ghosts kind of in every corner. And it's one of his most classic works, you know, just filled with terror, you know, and it's a very enjoyable book. Although it's not really, when you think about it, I've talked about this before, John, with you. It actually is a pretty heavy book just because of what Stephen King himself was going through at the time that he wrote it. So it was like the early 70s, and he was like, you know, the character of Jack Torrance has this addiction to alcohol, a problem with addiction, and he ends up becoming abusive to his wife and his son in the story in a very gross and famous way, an exaggerated way. But Stephen King at the time had two or three young children, and he was utterly ensnared in the grip of drugs and alcohol at the time he wrote The Shining. And so this, in a way, sort of sticking with the ghostly theme in a way, is kind of the writing of the book The Shining was kind of almost like a work of exorcism, you know, of trying to like dispel himself from some of the evil spirits that had taken over his world and his life. But I don't need to say too much more about it. It's a very creepy book. It's a really fun book to read. It's long. It has the elements of the most classic King stories, especially his novels, where there's all these disparate elements kind of in one place, and it kind of like really gradually comes together through circumstance and accident and stuff like that, building up into kind of this slow boil until it just, you know, absolutely explodes in mayhem and chaos at the end of the novel, and which is quite literal in this case, if you've read the novel The Shining. You know, it all explodes in like blood, fury, you know, fire and mayhem. You know, so for those, you know, with an appetite for a sprawling horror story that's jammed to the gills with ghosts, you can't do much better than to read The Shining.
That's a great riff on The Shining, you know, like, and this is where I make my confession. Because I think you know this, I've actually never read The Shining.
Yeah, I do know that, yeah.
In fact, I've really, as you know, I haven't read most of the big classic Stephen King novels that are considered to be his best, which would include either The Shining or It or The Stand. I did read Carrie, which was his debut novel. But anyway, those three, and obviously The Dark Tower, which is a much bigger thing. But those are considered some of his magnum opus books, and I haven't read any of them. I've read a lot of Stephen King, but not those. So
what about Pet Sematary? You ever read that?
I think I did read that one. And that's a lot of people think that's his scariest book, and I would say, from what I know, it probably is. And I thought about that one for this list too, but this is one of the things that we didn't really talk about. This is like what qualifies as a ghost story versus like kind of a zombie story, which is in some ways that's how I see Pet Sematary, because they're not ghosts that come in that case. It happens to be animals. They're not ghosts really that come back. They're like literally the resuscitated dead body come back, which to me, that's a different thing than a ghost.
Well, that's true. But also, this sounds like you're saying this about Shirley Jackson. And I'll keep it short, but some of these things sound like such a cliche, but at the time it was fairly novel, which was that, as you find out in Pet Sematary, was the kids established the cemetery over this burial ground of dead Native Americans. And so you could argue that it's the spirits of those dead people that drive, the reanimation of the animals. And by the way, there's also a straight up ghost in the novel Pet Sematary too. Guy that was killed on a bike on the highway, so you could argue. I thought about it too, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's sort of straw splitting, because you also then there's also the idea of one of the books that I thought about for this list was The Amityville Horror, which is made into a movie too. But there's a classic novel before the movie that was widely read. But that's like sort of a quote unquote possessed house, but that's more of a demonic possession, which is a little bit, I separated that out from although I'm about to break that rule a little bit. So the point is the lines
come and drag you away, John. So.
Yeah. The police, the lines are very thin between, some of these, is it a ghost book? Is it a demonic possession book? Is it a haunted house? But whatever. But anyway, The Shining certainly qualifies. And, you had to bring in Uncle Steve. We couldn't possibly have this conversation without bringing him in. So what I was going to do, we still have some time here. What I was going to do is bring up two more recent books. I try to make it short. And just for fun, I'm going to bring up one that was popular a couple of years ago and I think is absolutely terrible. So I'm going to pan one, which is, we don't often do on this show, but I'm going to.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's an example of a popular book that had to do with ghosts in recent years. And then there's another one a couple years earlier than that one, but a recent book that I thought was really a lot of fun. And it's kind of a different take on the whole ghost story thing. So I wanted to briefly go over those two. The book I hated was a book called A Head Full of Ghosts by a writer named Paul Tremblay. You've heard me rant about this book.
Yes.
And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it was just Paul Tremblay. I'd never heard of him before. It was one of these books that was famously blurred by Stephen King. This book scared the hell out of me. He's done that a lot, but this, supposedly he found this book very frightening and it kind of burst onto the scene. And I don't know, I found it somewhere cheap and I was like, I'm going to try this. I don't know anything about this writer. And, the title is A Head Full of Ghosts. I found this book was almost impressively unscary. And everything about this book was a total cliche. Every element of this book I had seen 1,000 times before. Dude, you're going to laugh. Keep laughing because the story involved
Greg, you were ranting and raving about this when you were reading it a couple years ago.
I could not believe, I'm reading this book, I'm like, I cannot believe this book is getting the acclaim it's getting. It's literally every cliche you can possibly imagine is in this book. So It involves like a suburban couple. They have two daughters. One of them, the book is narrated by the younger daughter, but her older sister starts displaying some strange behavior. They take her to various psychologists. She's like, you know, talking in weird voices and stuff. And like, you know, she's having behavioral issues. No one knows what's going on with her. They can't figure it out. So guess what they do, dude? They contact the local priest who comes in to see if they can perform an exorcism. I mean, eventually they decide to perform an exorcism on this girl. And, you know, chaos ensues from there. And it's just basically like a story of an exorcism gone bad. And, you know, the various demons get like led into the house and the whole thing. What he does, you know, he also decides to mix in like reality TV. So like, you know, there's like a reality TV crew that kind of hears about this story. So of course they're filming the whole thing, you know, every interview that this girl has with the priest, they're filming, and they film them trying to do this exorcism on the girl, which goes wrong. And they capture all this sort of like strange demonic activity in the house. And so like, there's a couple meta layers going on because like the younger sister is narrating the book and you're getting excerpts from her journal, which is describing what's going on. But then you also have these like videos that are being recorded for the reality TV show. So the, you know, you get a description of what's going on in those videos. And it's just like, you know, at some point the girl, you know, she becomes possessed and she starts speaking to them in other languages. And like, it's just, it's like The Exorcist, but mixed with like a reality TV show, you know, and that's the entire book. You know, there's simply, can you still hear me?
No, I'm sorry. I dozed off there.
I mean,
I don't know, what were you saying?
I thought I lost you there. I was about, that's funny because I was about to turn it off. But I mean,
I'm sorry. I ran the risk there. But
were you hearing me though?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, did you hear a single thing there that you haven't heard 100,000 times before in movies?
Not while I was awake, John. Not while I was awake. No, it's a fine line. It's so hard, but like, it was just funny when you were reading it. Because you were saying those things. You were like, man, dude, I don't know, like, what am I missing? Like, there's nothing in this book that hasn't been done a million times, and it sounds like you're right.
Oh, man. It was like, you know, it's describing, like, you know, they're interviewing the girl. It's kind of hard to explain just how cliche this book is, like, in this format. But, you know, she's got her head down, and she's, like, answering questions. And then all of a sudden she looks up, and her eyes are, like, red, and she's, like, talking in a different way. It's like just stuff you've seen so many times. And that was the whole, I kept waiting for like the unique twist, and it just was, it just never came. You know, it's just not everything. The book is just a cobbling together of numerous cliches that you've already read or seen in much better films or books, you know. And there wasn't a single thing about that book that was scary or original, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I've certainly come across other horror or scary stories that I like that had elements that were done 1,000 times. It's a very fine line, you know? Like, yeah. I don't know if it was just the idea of bringing the reality TV elements into it, and, you know, you thought it was just an inauthentic way to kind of bring it into, you know, up to speed with modern times or whatever. But you know it, like, you know, John, like, you're a very instinctive reader. You read a lot. Like, you know, if it's working, you would feel it. And if it's not, you know, your instincts are usually correct. You know, there was just something that he was doing. Like, he wasn't doing enough that was interesting or original, you know?
Or that you haven't seen 100 times. It was just, I was just kind of blown away by how unoriginal this book was. So we don't need to spend any more time on that, but that's an example of a recent book, like ghost/horror book that was like loudly hyped that I thought was terrible.
Yeah, interesting.
There was one a couple years before that I know you've read too, so we could, you know, briefly talk about it, that I thought did have a really original twist on the whole, you know, ghost story, haunted locale idea. And that is a book called Horror Store, which is all one word, without the E. So R-R-O-R-S-T-O-R, with the little umlauts above the final O, which is crucial. Because, this is a novel about a large box furniture store that's obviously modeled after or modeled on IKEA. And that's why they have the umlauts. It's like this, I can't remember what the store is called, but it's like sort of this vaguely Swedish name. And the store is haunted by ghosts and other, you know, malevolent spirits. And it's about kind of this sad sack who's like sort of down on his luck. So he gets a job working for this like big box, you know, furniture store. And some of the people that he gets to know at the job, they like call him up and ask him to come in for the overnight shift because they see some strange things happening in the store. And so, number one, just the idea of like a haunted, you know, big box store is a pretty cool idea. You know, I'd never heard of that before. But he also...
Haunted IKEA.
It's like, it's basically, this is the haunted IKEA novel, but he had the genius idea also.
Sorry.
What's that?
I said that you never knew you wanted.
That you never knew you wanted. But he also had the genius idea to like literally mod, because most people of a certain generation will remember the IKEA catalog, and he had these kind of like all these vague, weirdly Swedish names and different like, you know, schematics of how their furniture gets put together. Well, the book itself is structured like it's one of these catalogs. So, like, it literally looks like one of those catalogs, but it's also like each section is named after a different piece of furniture. You know, it's just, it's very creative how it like blends. It's a, like you said, you never knew you needed this, but the idea of like blending the whole IKEA culture with like a ghost story is really weird. But it's, but, and this is like, this is definitely a horror comedy. You know, so they, it's like an office comedy blended with a ghost story blended with IKEA. And it's really, it's off the wall and weird, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
And this one, you know, it uses that old cliche that we've already brought up a few times, like with Pet Sematary, like with Poltergeist, where you have a location that was built over a previous location, which is usually an Indian burial ground. You know, but I mean that I, you know, Pet Sematary, Poltergeist, it's like, you know, you never should have built here, see, because there's other stuff going on underneath the ground, you know, but in this,
you didn't bother to find out, and now they're extremely pissed off.
Exactly. Like, you didn't do the research, and but in this case, the whole store was built over this like insane asylum that was run by this guy who was conducting these like crazy experiments on the inmates. And that guy's ghost or spirit is haunting the store. So, you know, it's got this whole twisted history, but what's kind of fun too is like they find in one of the stock rooms or something, they find like a door that leads down underneath the store where the remnants of the old insane asylum are. And so, and the sort of demonic, you know, spirit that's haunting the store is used to be the warden of this, you know, insane asylum. But he has this whole group of like minions basically, and they're all ghosts. And he kind of sends them out, you know, through the store in one night to kind of, you know, wreak havoc. And so it's like, it sounds really silly, but it's like the whole thing is like meant to be sort of, like I said, it's kind of a weird cross between like a, not an office per se, but like a work comedy or a workplace comedy with like a really weird, twisted, you know, ghost story. And it's just such a bizarre mix of elements, but the way the book is physically packaged, the way it's written, the humor in it, I thought it all came together and just worked. And it's like, the scares are effective enough, but it's also very funny. And it's just I just thought it was a rollicking good time. Do you remember much about that book?
Yeah, I want to bring up a couple of things I remember. Hey, it's a great pick. Listen, I want to say to her, I'm speaking directly to our listeners now. I'm speaking to the demon that's possessing John. You know, like... No, I'm speaking directly to our listeners now. Like, if you could take nothing else from this episode, and if you're up for a rowdy good time... Okay, Horror Store is totally ridiculous. John is right. But I don't want to say buckets. It is large, squarish... awkward bins of fun to read this book. It is a lot of fun. And some of the little details I remember, John did a good job describing it. But the idea of having this haunted IKEA store and also making it kind of like an office-like comedy, you know, doubled the fun for me because this guy's such a slouch and he's complaining all the time about doing, you know, his job and doing a shift. So yeah. Keep that in mind. John's absolutely right. The design elements of the book and the way the book is executed is the key here to make it look like one of those old IKEA catalogs. Like even on the cover of the book, it's like really neat and it looks exactly like one of those catalogs. But if you flip it over on the back, there's like, it's also really neat and it's like the rest of the display, but there's some like vaguely sinister elements, you know, like on the back of the book, like a couple wet footprints and like, you know, like the also genius. And the other thing I wanted to mention about it was all the other elements John brought up were spot on. And then each chapter is introduced with a diagram, like a catalog looking, instruction book looking diagram of some kind of weird piece of furniture from the horror store. And what I thought was just awesome was that these images, which look exactly like those instruction booklets, begin rather innocuously, but the further the book goes on, they look more and more torturous as the book continues, I also thought was a stroke of genius. You know, this book is a ton of fun. You know, if you're up for a fun ghost story, you really can't miss Horror Store. And we shouldn't, we haven't done this yet, but we got to mention the guy that wrote it. His name, if you didn't say it, his name is Grady Hendrix. He has a lot of like horror comedy type of books. None of them, in my opinion, I've read at least one other one, are as effective as this one. But Grady Hendrix is the guy that wrote Horror Store. So,
but he also, he put out that book called Paperbacks from Hell, which was just like a collection of like 70s and 80s, like really, you know, dime store kind of horror and fantasy novel covers, right? Or like little reviews of these books, which I think I gave to you.
Yes, I have.
Just for fun. And it's just like great fun to read it or leaf through it and see some of these ridiculous books from like the 70s and 80s. But yeah, there's the Horror Store. It's like I wanted to bring it up with Paul Tremblay's book. I'm sorry, Paul, if you're listening, but you know, A Handful of Ghosts, because it's like everything that, you know, there are some cliches in it, but he just puts really interesting twists on it and he makes it funny. And it's just like something I'd never encountered before, which is the opposite of Head Full of Ghosts, which is just like everything you've encountered 100 times before, you know? So, and I know there's been talk about adapting both of those books into movies or series or something. And I don't think either one has shown up yet, but I think it's safe to say listeners will know which one I would vote to see, you know, first or at all. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we're getting to the end of my list. I know, you probably have at least one more that you want to cover.
I have two more, and I think I'll just consolidate them like we do sometimes just to cover them quickly. And I've talked about both books at least once anyway. So I'll just cover them both right now if that's cool with you.
Yeah.
All right, so the first book I want to talk about, I know I've mentioned before, it's a kind of, again, this is not really a genre story, like a traditional ghost story, but it definitely have ghosts in it. I think it came up, I don't remember exactly when, John, but I think it came up fairly recently. It could have been off camera, but I think it was on an episode. But it's a contemporary novel called Solar Bones, written by this Irish writer named Mike McCormick. And I just wanted to bring it up kind of in this context. Mike McCormack, sorry. I've said before, it's a novel about a guy who's like a father and a husband who is, you learn kind of early in the book, spoiler alert, has died kind of right at the beginning. And again, it's set in Ireland. It's an Irish writer. And he's kind of sitting at his kitchen table. And then throughout the course of the novel, he kind of reviews the couple of weeks leading up to his death. And so he's doing it from a ghostly perspective. Like he's somebody who's just kind of crossed over And I can't remember for sure, but I'm not sure if his family realizes. I think his family is absent, and he's sitting there, and he's dead. He's at the table, but he's dead. And he's reviewing kind of his life, and particularly the last couple of weeks of his life. And he's kind of a guy who's arrived at this sort of somewhat depressed, middle-aged state in life, and then he has this tragic death. And he's looking back on his life. And I really liked it. It's a really interesting book. It has everything to do with marriage and fatherhood and sort of community life in kind of a rural part of Ireland. And it has a lot to do with his occupation as an engineer, like a structural engineer. And so a lot of times he kind of brings in different elements of the work that he was doing and kind of what was in his mind when he was doing it, and like what his passions were, what he was trying to achieve through his work. And he talks in kind of a really eloquent manner about the work that he, kind of his life's work of engineering. And it's just written in a very interesting way also, because it's like a lot of books, it sounds like a kind of a cliche, but it sort of lacks, it doesn't lack paragraph breaks, but it lacks punctuation, I think. It either has no periods or a very rare period. And it'll, like, break up, especially when he's recounting dialogue and stuff. But there's no capital letters. And it all just kind of continues in kind of a, I hate to use the cliche of stream of consciousness, but it's like a stream. And it takes a while to get your head around the style. And it's very, did you say something or want to say something?
No, I just said yeah.
Okay. And a lot of people find that off-putting or, like, some kind of gimmick. I didn't. I thought it made sense in terms of the person who was doing the speaking, and, you know, the fact that he was just kind of revisiting things and almost rehashing his whole story, you know, from this ghostly place, if you will. So I thought it sort of made sense. And we've talked before about books with intimidating approaches or structures and the way that your mind kind of adjusts to it. And I've learned just personally, I'm not, you know, everybody reads the way they want to, but I've learned to have patience with that kind of thing. And I'm bringing that up now because it also plays into the next book I'm going to bring up for a different reason. But it was one of my favorite books the year I read it a couple years ago. I thought it was a really moving story. I related to it a lot as a father. And I just bring it up now because it was the whole story is told by like a ghost, you know? So it's this kind of like, it has this tone of somebody who's kind of on the other side of the Rubicon or whatever.
Narrated by a ghost.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a lot of stories like that as well. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, or should I go quickly move on to the last book I wanted to bring up?
Just that I'm, I think I gave this book to you, as I think you mentioned, or maybe didn't, but
no, I didn't, but you did.
I was very intrigued by it, and I'm still intrigued by it, and the fact that you had such a strong reaction to it is definitely one that I plan on catching up with at some point.
Yeah, I think it's really worth reading. And then the other book is another one I brought up to you a lot, John, and I know you know that I'm a big fan of it. But it's a totally different, it's also a challenging read, but for a totally different style. You might know where I'm going, but the book is called The Wake by
an
English writer named Paul Kingsnorth. It's the first volume of a trilogy, a very ambitious trilogy that includes three novels. The first one is The Wake. The second is called Beast, and the third one is called, Alexandria. I have read the first two. I have not read Alexandria, but it's a very ambitious project in that it takes place over the course of, I think, about a millennia, like 1,000 years, in one sort of rural region of England. So far, The Wake is my favorite of the two. The Wake is set in, like, medieval times. And it's about this warrior living in, like, a little village who's making his way sort of up the chain, you know, in a time of great, like, turmoil between different tribes, you know, in a kind of a really sort of a Beowulfish, you know, style or time period. He's just with a wife, you know, sort of like a wench and like a kid or whatever. And he's trying to make his way up the ranks of the warriors and prove his worth, etc. But it's the book is written in this made-up old English that when you first glance at it, when you first find, you know, attempt to start reading this book, you literally can't understand the words. Most of them are very short syllables, and they're spelled in a way that doesn't make sense to you. But it has this, it has a glossary at the back, which has only some of the words. And anyway, it's very intimidating at first, and I wasn't sure about it. But I thought it was a very fascinating story. I found that once I started to get, sort of remember different words that repeated what they meant, it became easier for me as I read the book to understand what was being said. I also thought, and this is just because I'm a dork, it was a really interesting book to read out loud, which, you know, I was trying to like read it out loud and like understand what was being said, and that actually helped me. And I grew in my ability to read the book as it went on. But what I found out about that was that it gave the book a very different atmosphere than almost any book I've ever read, even from that period. But as it relates to our theme, you know, I know at least one other person who read it and said that it was just kind of making weird language for, you know, doing something weird for its own sake, and they found it off-putting and stopped reading it. I imagine a lot of people would do that. I don't recommend that readers do that. I think they should hang with it. I think it's worth reading. But there's this lake. So they're kind of in this lakish district, and there's this lake that this warrior lives near. And every time he goes there, near there, or out in a boat on the lake or something, there are these ghostly figures that rise from the bottom of the lake, and they're his ancestors. And they speak to him, not in a threatening manner, but they're always kind of challenging him. They're like, have you done this yet? Or when are you going to, you know, vanquish this guy? Or this guy is kind of, you know, doing things with your wife that you don't know he's doing or whatever, and you need to go take care of business. It's like the spirits that rise from the bottom of the lake are like his forebears, and they're kind of pissed and not really happy with, you know, his success. And they kind of egg him on. And that's why I brought it up in the context of this theme, because it was a really interesting way to weave like these ghostly spirits into the book. And they would like emerge from like the murk of the water, and he would hear them kind of chastising him from the dark lake, you know? And I thought that was very fascinating. And obviously I thought the entire book was fascinating. So that's why I bring that up. The writer's name is Paul Northfield. Do I have that right? Kings North. Paul Kings North. And it's the first book of that trilogy. It's called The Wake. Very challenging, but really worth reading in my opinion. So
yeah, I was wondering, how it relates to this topic or this list, but you brought it back around there nicely. But what you were describing there reminds me a little bit just from your description of the part in The Lord of the Rings where Aragorn leads a couple people into that deep cavern and he sort of encounters like the ghost army, and it's like, you know, basically their ancestors, you know, from a much earlier time, and he like recruits them basically to help them win the battle, you know, in the Return of the King.
Yeah.
But he has this sort of negotiation with all these old warriors who are like their ancestors of his line, and he basically has to convince them that he's their king and they should do his bidding. But it reminds me a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's a great comparison.
Yeah. So let's see. So we need to kind of. Well, no, you know, we're bringing as much as we can into this, and we're going to wrap things up.
Yeah, I was going to, there are two more short stories that I wanted to discuss, but I think I'll probably table that because just in terms of time, I do want to mention, I have to mention one of them really quickly because it's a short story. It's only about 6 pages long, but you remember there's a book of there's a nature writer named Barry Lopez, Jude, that I know you've heard of before. I don't know if you've ever read him, but he wrote the book called Arctic Dreams. That's a very, you know, is a very well-known book. He's a very highly respected writer about ecology and nature and the natural world. Well, he wrote a lot of different stuff, but he has one short volume of short stories that's called Winter Count. You've heard me talk about it before.
Yes.
But I love that book. It's a series of very, it's about maybe 8 stories. They're all really short, but they're all have to do with different animals and like, you know, in different you know, types of situations. Like, for example, there's one kind of beautifully written short story about a flock of cranes that sort of like finds themselves diverted in their migration and lands in the middle of like Times Square or somewhere in New York City, like during a snowstorm, and just creates a sort of beautiful scene that you wouldn't expect. Anyway, I just had to bring this up. I'm just going to bring it up because it's like, I love Barry Lopez. His writing on nature and the natural world. He wrote a book about wolves that I can't remember what it's called, but he's a beautiful writer and highly worth seeking out. If you have any interest in nature writing or the environment or anything like that, Barry Lopez has passed away now, but he's like one of the greats in this field. But this very small volume of short stories includes a story called Buffalo. And it's literally, it's just a short story about a, I'm blanking on the word, but a group of ghost buffalo.
Herd?
A herd, thank you. A herd of ghost buffalo that appear like way up in the mountains of Wyoming. And it's in about six pages, it describes, it's like in 1840 something or 50 something. There's a record breaking snowstorm. It's just brutal. And just, it happens overnight. Everything freezes. And there are these people up in the mountains somewhere in Wyoming. And you can just, I mean, you can imagine how brutally cold it is. And they're out hunting buffalo. But all the buffalo, the weather is, the storm is so bad that there's about 4 feet of snow on the plains. And all the, it kills all the buffalo, despite their fur or whatever. And then a little bit later, they're walking and they're trying to get out of the snowstorm in the mountains. And they notice in the distance, like a herd of like much larger, you know, about 10 or 12, much larger, like 8 feet tall, white buffalo. And it describes it as being entirely white with like sky blue eyes. And they're just like in the distance. And it's like this herd of ghost buffalo. And then it sort of explains how this is. The idea of the ghost buffalo goes back in various mythologies of the North American Indian tribes. And like, you know, for a lot. And so like somebody, one of the characters has said, oh yeah, you know, I saw this blanket once that was made by this elder in this tribe. And it depicted a herd of ghost buffalo. So it kind of, the rest of the story just sort of describes these little incidents where there were people like either among the mountains or Native American tribes or groups of hunters that claim to have seen ghost buffalo up in those mountains. And so there's this like, you know, ongoing rumor across the years that there still exists these like white ghost buffalo. And it's just, that's all it is. It's just like this depiction of like this brutal storm. And supposedly a herd of ghost buffalo come out of the storm. But it's just the way the story is written. It's just fascinating. It was just like, you know, I had to bring it up in this context because it's like, there's only a couple examples that I could think of ghost stories that involve animals, but this is probably my favorite one because it's just a brief, very beautifully written little tale about this herd of ghost buffalo. And it's just like fascinating, you know, just that idea that there's the notion that there can be ghost buffalo in the mythology of some of the, Native tribes in this country in itself is pretty fascinating, but it's beautifully written and would take about 5 minutes to read, but it's awesome. So I just wanted to bring that one up.
Well, folks, I, you know, it's only here on the Book Exchange podcast. I bet you didn't expect that you would get Ghost Buffalo in this episode, but you got it here.
It popped into my mind because I remember I went back and reread it because I'd read it years ago, but I was like, oh yeah, I remember that story about the ghost buffalo. And it's just fascinating. Maybe because I spent some time in Wyoming, you know, that's another layer. But I love stuff like that. Just imagining something that is so otherworldly that you couldn't possibly imagine it.
Right.
I wanted to just throw that in there because I thought it was worth a mention. But I think we're pretty much done. If you want to tie it up there.
All right. Well, I think, you know, so we, you know, we're at almost 2 hours here, so we're going to wrap it up and talk quickly about what we're reading, and then I'll let John tease the next one. But I think we kind of covered a lot of ground, maybe some unexpected titles, and we managed to have a pretty good discussion about the ghost story, or the ghost genre, if you will, which obviously goes in many, many different directions. So, John, unless you have another comment, we'll transition into what we're going to read next.
No, I don't. I'm going to let you start, because with what I'm going to read next is kind of segues into what we're going to do for the next episode.
Okay, so I'm not really sure to answer the question, but I'm sort of leaning toward, you and I were together recently, and, you know, I guess I'll just say it's subject to change, because I've been working on this large anthology for so long, and I still have, I don't know, at least 300 pages to go in that book, if not more. But I'm leaning towards one of my favorite writers that hasn't come up a lot on this podcast, of both short stories and novels from the American South, is this writer by the name of Ron Rash. And when you and I were together recently, we got to go to a used bookstore down there in Maryland. And remember, you found this pristine hard copy version of one of Ron Rash's recent books, and you showed it to me, and I bought it kind of on the spot. Because I'm a huge Ron Rash fan. He's a very talented novelist and short story writer, contemporary, still around, who happens to write mostly about the regions around Appalachia. He's probably best known for a novel called Serena, which was made into a not very good film adaptation with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. Kind of a Lady Macbeth figure, the novel Serena, set in Appalachia. Anyway, that was probably the best known of his books. And not too long ago, I believe it's the last book he's written, he came out with kind of a new collection of stories called In the Valley. But the title story was like actually a novella that was a continuation of the story of Serena from the novel Serena. So it was like about almost a 100-page story about this character, Serena, and then 8 or 10 other stories. And I just know Ron Rash. Ron Rash is one of the great contemporary American writers that most people have not heard of.
Mm-hmm.
But people really ought to be reading him, unless they don't want to read about Appalachia or the South. He's a very powerful, often very dark, but a very powerful writer. So I think I'm going to read that next, because I'm such a big fan of his work. I didn't necessarily think I was going to read that immediately. Sometimes books sit on my shelves for many years, but not in this case. So I think I'm going to go with In the Valley by Ron Rash. How about you?
Nice. Well, that's a great pick. I've only read one book by Ron Rash, which was a collection of his stories called Something Rich and Strange. And there's a title story, you know, by that name that I remember being really, really good. But that I remember that book being kind of knocking me off my chair, too. The writing of his short stories was fantastic. So he's definitely someone I want to read more of. In terms of what I'm reading next, it's going to lead us right into sort of, you know, teasing the next episode. About 3 episodes ago, we kicked off a series, a new series, and that we call Read Around the World, which is basically our way of kind of being armchair travelers and exploring different parts of the world that we may or may not ever get to. And so the second best option, besides actually getting to those places, is to read about them. So we wanted to just kind of unpack the literature and the writing from different parts of the world. We thought that would be fun. We thought it would be interesting. We thought it would lead to some discoveries, both for us and our listeners. So we're gonna do our second episode there. The first one, as I said, about 3 episodes back, we talked about literature from Australia and New Zealand and Tasmania. And this time, what we're going to do is we're going to take on just one country, but it's a vast one, and that is Mexico. And we both read, you know, a fair amount of books that were either set in Mexico or written by Mexican writers. Certainly, I've read less of the latter category. It's a very rich culture with a rich and conflicted history that I think we could attack from a whole number of angles. So we're going to, in preparation for that, one of the most famous Mexican writers that I'm embarrassed to say I've never read any of his books, though many of them are famous, is a guy whose name I'm all of a sudden like, Carlos Fuentes is the name of the writer.
Okay.
And he is, you've heard of Fuentes before, I'm going to assume.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's one of the great and most well-known writers from Spain in the last, 100 years at least. And I don't think he ever won the Nobel Prize, but I know he was nominated a number of times. Anyway, he has a number of famous books, most of which are set in Mexico.
John, did you just say he was from Spain?
Did I? If I did, that was
okay.
A mistake.
All right, I thought you said he's one of the writers from Spain, and I was like, is he from Spain or from Mexico?
No, that was just a stupid error. We're talking about Mexico here.
Gotcha.
One of his early novels that I do have that's a really big, thick novel, and it's about Mexico and various parts of Mexican history in the 20th century, and it's called When the Air is Clear. That's the either Where the Air is Clear or When the Air is Clear. I can't remember, but it's obviously a title in translation. But I have that book on my shelf. I've never read it. Someday I'm going to take it on, but I've never read it. But what I am going to read is he has a shorter novel. That's one of his more recent books. I believe he's passed away now, but he had, he was writing well into the 90s. And he wrote a book called Old Gringo. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yes, but I couldn't say much about it.
Well, it's a short novel, and it has to do with the American writer Ambrose Bierce, who is another fascinating writer that I find very interesting. But he went down to Mexico, I believe, to join in the revolution down there, or helped some of the Mexican revolutionaries to overthrow their government, and he disappeared. And no one knows exactly what happened to him. And that was in real life, he disappeared. And so this is a novel about Ambrose Bierce in Mexico, who I assume is a titular old gringo. And I thought that was a fascinating idea, for one famous writer to write about another famous writer who disappeared in his own country. So I'm going to start there with Carlos Fuentes because I've never read him before. So, and that's kind of kicker. There's a couple books that I wouldn't mind trying to, jam in if I can before we talk about books and writers from Mexico. So, but that's where I'm going to start to kind of like at least read one book by one of Mexico's most famous writers. So that, not only does that tease our next episode, episode 59, but it also covers what I'm reading. So I think with that, we should be pretty well done.
Yep, we are. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, but if you'd like to comment on the next episode or our plans for episode 59, go right ahead.
Well, no, I'm just excited. At first, I thought it was too soon to revisit the series, but then I thought to myself, there's a lot of places we ain't going to get to. So it's not like we're going to run out of reading around the world locations.
Yeah, I guess you could argue that. I suppose this is a little on-air production here, but I just thought, there's so many corners. It just, in my mind, it just keeps things interesting by, swerving to a totally different part of the world and maybe gives us a chance to explore some books and writers that we haven't taken on yet.
Yeah, and I was going to bring it up, but then I thought about better of it because it helps us kind of swerve into different themes and colors and layers, because it's always going to be different parts of the world. So there's no reason not to, carry on. But anyway, yeah, I've been trying to come up with some ideas of what I want to talk about for that episode. So I'm looking forward to it. I know there's at least one really contemporary Mexican writer that I want to bring up. And then there's some older books that I want to either try to get to. I may not get to them or whatever, but it's going to be a really colorful, interesting, rich discussion. And, it's a long way from ghosts. That's the way we like to play. Well, it could be. That's the way we like to play it around here. We're going to keep zigzagging, and we hope you stay with us. But anyway, we want to thank you all for listening to another episode. This has been episode 58 of the Book Exchange Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you again the next time. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, everyone. We'll be back soon with another episode.
Bye-bye.